Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to an episode on the New Books Network. I'm one of the hosts, Liz Barrett, and I'm very happy today to be interviewing Dr. Debbie Felton. Professor Felton not only wrote Haunted Greece and Rome, Ghost Stories from Classical Antiquity, which would be perfect for this time of year, but also equally perfect Monsters and Monarchs, Serial Killers in Classical Myth and History, published by University of Texas Press in 2021. I mean, what is actually scarier than ghost stories? Serial killers. And turns out they've been here all along. Debbie, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me, Liz.
So first of all, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Oh, about me generally. Well, I teach at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst, Massachusetts, in the Department of Classics. And my work generally is about folklore and mythology, ancient folklore and mythology, and I teach classes that are related to that. So I teach a course on magic in the ancient Mediterranean. Sometimes I teach Greek myth. I teach courses on Greek and Latin ghost stories. So like classical and medieval Latin ghost stories, ancient Greek ghost stories in the original languages. So those classes are for our upper level Greek and Latin students. And on completely different level, I teach a basic course on medical terminology. That's the one I offer most frequently, actually, because it's a lot of people want to take that.
Wow, that's fantastic. So magic in the Mediterranean, myth. Wow, that reminds me, I recently read a book, a novel, which was really fantastic. It was Circe.
Madeline Miller's book. Yep. Yeah. I just read that. I read that. Was it last year? Yeah, it was beautiful. Her writing is so beautiful.
Really is, yeah.
Yeah.
So anyways, back to Monsters and Monarchs. What is it about scary stories and classics that have so much allure?
Oh, you mean the combination of the classics? Allure is an interesting way to put it. Do you mean for me personally, or just why I think anyone might want to read about it?
Well, I mean, we can start with you personally, and we can expand to, you know, everyone else. I mean, I think, you know, right now, so recently, I haven't finished it, but Dahmer is on one of the channels, and you reference him in your book. So I really think, and you also talk about, I mean, I think terms are so important to your work, because the term serial killer, of course, is very recent.
Yeah.
So, I mean, can you talk about that a little bit first, maybe then?
Oh, yeah. Well, I can answer your initial question too.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. And I sort of, stop me if I'm getting too off track, but So when I was growing up, I was very interested in classical mythology and folklore in general, but I did read a lot of Greek mythology. And I was also interested in ghost stories. And I think this is partially because my dad actually was interested in ghost stories. We had a lot of books around the house, like these ghost story anthologies, Victorian and 20th century ghost stories. And so when I ended up in the field of classics, which was kind of like, you know, a circuitous route, because I had never heard of classics until I was like, a senior in college, I kid you not. I started thinking about, well, are there intersections? Like, are there classical ghost stories? Are there stories about, are there other scary stories besides the ones in, you know, myth about monsters? And what about serial killers? And the serial killers part is just sort of unfortunately, because I grew up in Los Angeles in the 1960s and 70s, and the Charles Manson and his family were prominently in the news for many, many years, not only for the killings, but for the trials that went on and on and on. And we also, like the Zodiac Killer was still in the news too, because he was never found. And, you know, Hillside Stranglers, there just seemed to be an unusual number of serial killers floating around California in the period when I was growing up. And so they were just constantly in the news as if it were some sort of a new phenomenon, aside from Jack the Ripper, you know, over in the 1880s in England. These are mostly the people that I heard about, was the ones in California. And so eventually it occurred to me to see whether there were any similar stories from classical antiquity. And you mentioned the term serial killer, well, that didn't exist before the 1970s or even the 1980s. And it's not like the Greeks and Romans had some special term or phrase for the equivalent of what we would think of as a serial killer, somebody who kills, you know, more than one person, more than two people usually, over a period of time and by similar methods is the general working definition. And it's not like the Greeks and Romans had anything like that, but it's clear from the stories and some historical records that have survived that they did know of crimes like that. They just didn't have a separate word for it other than killer or murderer.
Right, and so they came up with stories that they would tell in order to explain this phenomena. So one of the stories was the Sphinx, which sounds absolutely terrifying. Can you talk about how you wove that into your book and how you link it with modern society? Because I found this fascinating.
Well, it's nice of you to say so. So you're asking about the Sphinx from the story of Oedipus, right?
Right, the Theban Sphinx.
The Theban Sphinx. So because there were the Sphinx was just sort of a hybrid monster that existed long before it appeared in that particular story. And like a lot of mythological monsters, the Sphinx in the Oedipus story, the Sphinx was famous for her riddle. And anyone who couldn't solve her riddle, she would kill. And her riddle was, you know, what goes on four legs in the morning, two legs at noon, and three legs in the afternoon? And the answer is man or a human being, because they crawl on all fours as an infant and walk upright on two legs in adulthood and then need a cane in old age. So the Sphinx represents a lot of things besides just reflecting what we think of as serial killer behavior. She had a riddle that she wanted people to solve. It, and she targeted young men specifically, as they were the ones who would go out and try to solve her riddle, because she was basically blocking the town of Thebes, people entering and exiting. It was just cut off from the larger Greek society. And so while, again, the Theban Sphinx has a lot of other associations, she does resemble what we think of as serial killers in the sense that she had a particular method of killing, a particular victim type, which is young men. And so there was a pattern, basically, and there was a sexual subtext to some of it as well. And there was even a sort of connection with disability in terms of Oedipus himself, who solved the riddle having a bad leg. You know, he was sort of limping himself. So, I mean, that's, in other words, there are a lot of different threads associated with modern serial killers that tie into that story. I, you know, we don't want to say that, oh yes, the Sphinx was made up for this story to definitely reflect a local serial killing in the area of Thebes. So we don't want to say anything as specific or restrictive as that, but we do want to say that a lot of these monsters from stories around the world do seem to reflect an understanding of serial killing. These were not young men that were sacrificed to the Sphinx. These were young men who were killed by the Sphinx by a particular method, possibly strangulation. But and her particular method was to ask a riddle before killing them. And there is this whole connection with riddling killers, actually, including like the Riddler from, you know, Batman stories. But I'm cleverer than you and I'm going to prove it. And if you can't solve my riddle, I'm going to kill you kind of motif.
Yeah, I really, the way you weave it all together and explain how there's these sort of archetypes in myth and the types of myths themselves that are indicative of certain kinds. So for example, you talk about the Bluebeard type, right? So yeah. Can you explain that a little bit more?
Sure. Well, there's a sort of subset of serial killing stories. I'm going to say stories, not historical records, although there are those too in later time periods. But there's this whole subset of stories where you've got what we call bluebeards, which are husbands who kill wives, who kill their wives. Like they'll kill one and then they'll remarry and kill another and they keep killing wives. So they're called bluebeards after the folktale or fairy tale of a man literally called Bluebeard because of the shade of his beard, who did kill his wives and kept all their corpses locked up in a room in his castle. We also have the Black Widows, which is basically the female version, which are women who kill a series of husbands and sometimes even other family members also. And both Blackbeards, sorry, that's a pirate, sorry. Black Widows and Bluebeards, both basically are serial killers of spouses, and they do seem to reflect, real type of serial killer. That may not be the reason the stories were originally told, but we do find the actual serial killing patterns reflected in those stories anyway. However, those stories came up, they definitely reflect a real life phenomenon.
You also discuss the Bluebeard legend in this way, which I thought was really interesting, which was how the wife is told, don't go in this room. And she gets the key and she goes in the room, and that's when she sees all the body parts and she drops the key and the key is stained red. So you talk about this could be kind of a metaphor for a story that, you know, mothers would tell their daughters about, you know, you could, when you have sex with your husband, you can get pregnant and that can kill you. And so the key being stained red, just the way that you sort of link, you know, kind of our common sense, sort of modern thought about linking things to a real metaphor from the past is really great. I loved it.
Thanks. I mean, I think some of those, you know, interpretations are culled from other sources. I mean, because there's another one that the key with the blood on it, you know, you insert the key in the hole and now there's blood on the key, is a metaphor for lost virginity also. So before you even get to the pregnancy and the high mortality rate for women giving birth in certain points in history, and along with basically the death in childbirth is, yeah, I mean, there are just a lot of different ways to interpret these stories. So it's fun to think about what they could mean and why they were told. And certainly if your wife died in childbirth, you would get married again and possibly lose another wife to childbirth. I mean, it's just, yeah.
It's true. It's sad and it's true. So from the Bluebeards to the Black Widows, right? So tell us about this type of killer in antiquity and in myth and maybe now. What do we have?
So for Black Widows, more, you mean specifically? So mm-hmm. like we were talking about before, the Black Widow is the female version really of the Bluebeard in terms of this is someone who marries and kills her husbands, but also potentially other family members, like more so than a Bluebeard who might kill wives and maybe some offspring. But the Black Widow type kills husbands, but also basically any other people who kind of get in the way of what she wants, whatever she thinks her happiness is going to be, if that's an inheritance or just control or just attention. And so the Black Widow can sometimes even be a woman suffering from Munchausen syndrome by proxy, just liking to have all the attention because her child has died or her husband has died. And they generally have to be careful because if they kill enough people, it starts being a little more obvious that, gee, all of your close family members are dying. This is more than a coincidence. Anyway, in terms of antiquity, for both the Bluebeard and the Black Widow, it can be hard to find examples that are like as clear as the ones from later folktale and more modern society. But there are certainly examples and also reasons why there are fewer. So for example, in terms of Black Widows in antiquity, women led much more guarded lives in ancient Greece and Rome than they do now in terms of being allowed to go out on their own without being accompanied by a male family member. They didn't have as much social freedom. And this was partially because their husbands wanted to make sure that any offspring that the woman had, you know, the paternity, the father was known. And if you let the women go out by themselves, so clearly they cannot be trusted and they will have affairs and you'll never be sure if the child is yours or not. And you don't want to leave your inheritance to a male child, especially who's not yours. So women led much more guarded lives. So it's less easy to find examples of Black Widows, but sometimes you can point to a Roman woman of the imperial family, like Messalina, for example, the wife of the Emperor Claudius. He was 30 years older than she was. And in terms of our historical sources, because she's a historical figure, the issue is always, well, how biased are your sources? I mean, you have some Roman writers of history who just really hated the imperial family or hated specific people in it. So you're not going to get like a very neutral view of some of these characters. But there seems to have been a lot of agreement that Messalina, the wife of Claudius, was a pretty horrible person in terms of being highly adulterous, maybe even nymphomaniac, power crazy, to the extent that anybody that disagreed with her, anybody that she took a dislike to, she would convince Claudius, her husband, the emperor, to have them executed. And she could lie about reasons like, oh, well, he tried to rape me or something, when really it was that she wanted to have sex with him and the guy like didn't want to because he knew what kind of trouble he could get in if he did. And so there are all sorts of stories along those lines that if she was jilted, she would accuse the guy of actually being inappropriate with her. Or, you know, maybe, I mean, there are a lot of other reasons, like someone just wouldn't do what she said or threatened to tell Claudius. Not that he believed, you know, anything bad about her. So she wasn't killing her husbands. She was killing her lovers. She was having them executed. There are differences. She wasn't killing them herself, right? Well, you've got these Black Widows in later history, like Marianne Cotton or Bell Guns or what have you, who actually poison the people themselves. Like they will poison their own family members, their husbands, their children, their in-laws. Whereas someone like Messalina wasn't killing anyone by her own hand. She was causing their deaths by telling her husband to have them executed. So, but the motivations could be, you know, similar in some senses. So here's someone who's standing in the way of what I want. So let's get rid of them.
Yeah, I mean, clearly, I guess she's taking advantage of the power that she had. And why get her hands dirty if she doesn't have to? Let's stay on the Imperial Roman family for a minute. Let's talk about Nero and his mother.
Okay. So Agrippina, Nero's mother, is another one who we would want to call her a Black Widow. Necessarily, she's, again, it's not the serial killing of spouses or lovers in her case, but she definitely wanted her son Nero to become emperor and have power. So she would try to see to it that anyone who stood in the way of that lineage was killed somehow, whether that meant hiring a poisoner herself or, you know, hiring a hitman. She does seem to have been responsible for quite a few deaths, younger male family members who stood in the way in the more direct line of becoming emperor than her son Nero did. And, and Nero himself then tried to at one point have his mother killed because, I mean, just so many reasons. But, you know, he had several failed attempts at having his mother executed before he finally managed to have some soldiers go ahead and do that. And Nero, he was so, again, with you know, viewing him through our sources, which clearly people who clearly hated him are the ones who wrote the history, he was pretty depraved, according to them. And he himself, you know, they describe him in terms that we would think of as modern serial killer terms. So the background they give us on Nero is that even when he was a boy, he was showing depraved behavior and a lack of empathy and disregard for human life. He was acting out. He would, as he was growing up, he would cause fights, like bar fights, for example. He'd crack people's heads, you know, with benches and things. He supposedly went out and in disguise and killed people. How these historians would know that it was Nero in disguise, you know, for example, is not clarified. And we have to take a lot of this information with a grain of salt. But Nero was clearly loathed by huge numbers of people. And, you know, as he grew up, I mean, the stories just basically continued in terms of he set things on fire, he had people killed or killed them himself, which is, you know, the interesting part that is more resembling modern serial killers. And, you know, he had all of these sexual, what would be called sexual deviances in terms of who he was attracted to, what he made them dress up as, for example. And it just basically is sort of continued as he grew up and became emperor. He and his mother sort of conspired to have various people poisoned who stood in his way. So there was a lot going on with Nero. This is, again, not to say that the Emperor Nero was definitely a serial killer. The point is that these historians knew enough about what we would think of as serial killers to describe Nero in those terms, including the background, like the really disturbed childhood with the absent parents and then the acting out and the getting in fights and the escalation of the violence. I mean, supposedly he raped people, you know, again, it's, and then, you know, moved on to killing people. So, but with Nero, you don't have the sort of, say, narrow patterns that you might associate with modern serial killers in terms of a consistent method of killing people, or even, you know, doing it at intervals. I mean, with Nero, he was just all over the place. What's interesting about the accounts of him is that background information that fits in with what we think of in terms of modern serial killers. I should probably put in the disclaimer that I am not a criminologist and I'm also not a psychologist. So this is more like the pop culture approach to serial killing. But we, you know, my point really is that we do see it in the ancient world.
Right.
People thought, well, that can't be. There's so much tendency to think of serial killing as a fairly modern phenomenon. Even if you only start with Jack the Ripper, that's still not that long ago, like, you know, 140 years or less.
Well, exactly. I mean, and that's the sort of, you know, the evolution of how we understand behavior. So we've only learned about, you know, coined the term serial killer, like you said, in the 70s or 80s. And so without having sources from antiquity saying Nero was clearly a serial killer and good thing that, you know, we took care of that, didn't, you know, sorry. Is kind of, you know, the point of looking back and then trying to interpret what sources we have in order to say, okay, well, he exhibits these types of behaviors. So this tells us a lot about how he influenced culture, society, politics, All the discourses that we like to bring up. So staying with Nero a little bit longer, let's talk about Locusta of Gaul.
Right. So I mentioned that Nero and his mother tended to have people killed. And one of the ways they did this was via an infamous woman poisoner, Locusta of Gaul. Locusta, I'm actually not sure what the best way is to say her name these days, Locusta of Gaul, but like locust or something, Locusta of Gaul. So one of the things to notice about her is that she is referred to as Locusta of Gaul. So Gaul was not Rome, right? Gaul was like what is now modern France. And so part of what seems to be going on with her is this, let's make sure we identify her as a foreigner because, you know, we don't want any like Romans getting famous for being poisoners. So there's something going on there in terms of the constant reference to her as, you know, in terms of where she's from, because they didn't do that with everybody. The Roman Empire was huge and they didn't always add the of Gaul or, you know, of North Africa or whatever when they were referring to people. So she stood out in that respect. And Locusta was interesting or stood out because she grew so famous as a professional poisoner. Like this was her profession. I mean, this is another reason why, you know, again, the shifting definition of like, what do we think of really as a serial killer? Locusta did it for, she was a poisoner for hire. We don't, if she poisoned a bunch of people on her own, we don't have those stories. What we know is that she was hired by Nero and his mother to poison people, including the Emperor Claudius. And Britannicus, one of the other heirs, potential heirs to the imperial throne. So, and we have these stories of Locusta testing her poisons, like, oh, let's try it on a goat or a pig and make sure it works before we try it on Claudius or someone, because we don't want there to, or on Britannicus, because they want these things to work the first time and not become suspicious. But Locusta seems to even have like taught other people her skill in poisoning. And the fact that she was so renowned and was able to get away with this for such a long time is partially because Nero kept pardoning her. When he finally died, his successor had her executed, basically. So was not as tolerant of openly famous poisoners. And poison was a fairly common method of trying to kill people surreptitiously. You couldn't necessarily prove that, you know, who had done it necessarily. And again, we're dealing with biased sources. So the historian Tacitus says, oh, it was Locusta of Gaul that they got it from. Well, maybe, you know, on the other hand, the story is so well known and pops up in other places. Locusta was so famous as a poisoner that other authors mention her. So it's just very weird how someone could be known to be a provider of poisons and that somehow wasn't illegal or illegal enough to have her, you know, removed and jailed, which right. She was at some point she was, you know, but she never stayed in prison for very long.
Mm-hmm. So that also ties into not just the bias of sources, but sort of, you know, maybe modern bias or the ways that, we now tend to, you know, sensationalize certain things. Locusta's execution sent me on a footnote and internet search rabbit hole. So you reference in the book that she was executed by being raped by a giraffe. So I've looked this up. Can you basically walk me through your footnote on that one?
Yeah, so that is a false story, actually. So I had to do what you're saying you did, because this did not sound right, actually. And like, where did that story come from that Locusta was executed by being raped by a giraffe? What's going on there? So it seems to be a conflation of various stories. We can say pretty certainly that that is not how she died, that she was executed, but there was no giraffe involved. This seems to have been, it's really hard to trace where the story actually first came from. I know that a serial killer, like the first edition of a particular serial killer book, had that story in it, and some people got it from there. In fact, I think Catherine Ramsland, who has been interviewed on New Books Network, who was in the past, she had noticed that story in there and wondered about it herself when she was writing some of her serial killer books. And that serial killer book that put in that story about Locusta being raped to death by a giraffe, that particular book didn't cite a source, but other people cited his book. I noticed that in the second edition of that book, that story was gone. So at some point, someone must have pointed out to that person. Obviously, I'm trying not to name the author because I don't want to embarrass anybody. But he must have noticed or been told or been informed that that was not an accurate story. What seems to have happened was that someone somewhere along the line, not in antiquity, but at a later point, conflated stories about animals in the arena versus executions related to animals. There were stories of women being punished by being raped, perhaps by a giraffe or a donkey or something along those lines. But Locusta was not one of those women. And we don't know the extent to which those things, like to what extent those were in stories, but not so much in real life. So wow. It's a little hard to sort it out. I think we know that that did not happen to Locusta. We know there are stories where women were raped by animals in the arena. One about a donkey comes to mind. Not sure about the giraffe. There were animal trainers. There were people who would train the animals to do those things in the arena by using like the scent glands from female giraffes or female animals and smearing them on the women who were going to be tortured and executed in that way. But that is not how Locusta herself died.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah.
Wow. That's shocking. So to kind of pivot a little bit.
By the way, is this what you found when you went down that rabbit hole? Did you like?
Well, all I found was that the giraffe raping did not happen, but right. I didn't dig far enough in, and this is the difference between real scholarship and reading a book and being intrigued by things on the page, right? So is that finding out that at the other end of it, there really was cases of women being executed through bestiality practices. Yeah. That's shocking and awful.
Yeah,
but
that's really horrific. Yeah.
Not surprising. I mean, so it's not surprising in the sense, not that, I don't want to judge any society, right? So not that they had, but that they had different customs and sets of morals and beliefs, and they celebrated things that we don't celebrate in the same way or that we abhor. So, and also now, I mean, you know, we watch reenactments, like I referenced the show Dahmer earlier. So we watch these, you know, true crime, we listen to true crime podcasts, we watch true crime on TV. It's a fascination. So I do wonder, and so you bring in something else in this book, which going back to the Sphinx and, you know, other killers that sort of inhabited roadways, you talk about like Rome was this sprawling empire that had roadways that linked for troop movements and communications. So also you talked about your childhood in California in the 60s and 70s in the period when, you know, during the Cold War, the roads are getting set, you know, the interstates getting built throughout the United States. So do you want to elaborate on that a little bit more too?
Oh, sure. In terms of like how much easier it is for serial killers to sort of be predatory on roadways, for example, there is definitely a lot of connections there. And so even, I mean, it goes back even before the Romans were building their own roadways, because you can take it all the way back to like 3,000 years ago when, say, in ancient Greece, people were finally starting to move out a little more. But there's a sort of xenophobia involved in terms of, well, I'm afraid of the people I might meet, you know, in these other places, and they're different from me, and I don't know what to expect, and I'm not sure how safe it is to travel. And yet people were traveling to try to open up trade routes and out of a sense of exploration. So they had mixed feelings about spreading out beyond the confines of their known areas. But you, so for example, before you even get to the Roman road network, you have stories of mythological heroes like Heracles, with his Roman name is Hercules, but Heracles to the Greeks. He was, a lot of his adventures involved going out and traveling very far, and he'd meet these dangers on the roadways. And a lot of those were people who remind us of serial killers, because they do have specific methods of killing and they take trophies and this and that. So the whole association of serial killers with roadways would seem to go back really, really far, depending again on how, you know, how the extent to which you want to consider some of those adventures as being very serial killer like, that is the people that Heracles met. And then by the time you get to Rome, and their empire is like so vast, it's like North Africa, Gaul, over, you know, towards India, etc. And you don't have enough troops to really monitor the roads. I mean, the ancient Greeks and Romans didn't have anything like modern police forces, even within towns. A lot of it was more like a neighborhood watch kind of thing. So the point there is that, like, it was much easier for highway robbers and similar predators to be out there on the roads to attack people and to not be caught, but to leave behind, you know, local stories of, oh my God, we kept finding mutilated bodies on, you know, on the side of the road, or people keep disappearing in this spot. What's happening to them? So there, we find that quite a few stories from ancient Greece and Rome, quite a few stories that sound a little bit like serial killing stories, happen on the roadsides. Someone's traveling, and this is like in the story of the Greek hero Theseus, for example. Someone is, you know, weary travelers meet somebody who says, hey, I have a little like hotel here, which back then meant like a hut with a cot in it, right? So do you want to spend the night there for like for cheap? And then you go to this stranger's house and they'd murder you, but they torture you first. So we have stories like that dating back quite far. And with the Romans, the highway killers, like highwaymen especially, seem to have been a real concern, because people were traveling much farther, and a lot of the people traveling were richer than they used to be as well, like merchants and all. So we have the stories of highway killers under the Roman Empire, some of whom did not work in groups. I mean, if you've got a group of highwaymen and they're basically beating you up and taking your money, that's one thing. If you've got a lone highwayman who is torturing you and then killing you and chopping your body into bits and throwing the bits around in the forest, you've got something that sounds more like a serial killer than a robber. And in fact, a lot of the stories didn't even, you know, they didn't even focus on the robbing aspect. They focused on the murder mutilation aspect, which again is far more serial killer like than just a typical robber mugger.
Yeah. You also talk about how there was an exercise, I believe, in rhetoric in school, and how, so it wasn't just that, you know, we in our society look back at these sources and hear these stories and create fictions based on them. They did it too. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, that's one of the stories from the ancient world that really sounds the most. I mean, there are a lot of good stories, but that one is so detailed that it really has probably the most in it that like resembles the story of a serial killer. So what you're referring to is a rhetorical exercise, meaning it's a fictional speech, basically. So it's a fictional story that was told to school children, maybe on the older side, who were maybe training for public speaking or to be a public defender or prosecutor, actually. And so this was a practice speech against a murderer. But the murderer, and they had lots of those. I mean, they had lots of practice speeches and actual real speeches that had been recorded, you know, maybe embellished a little bit, but they had real speeches against murderers that were actual historical cases. This one is a made up speech, but the level of detail in it is so impressive that it it would be hard to imagine somebody could write this without having heard of other stories like it, like that were real, that had really happened. So in this story, what you've got is a prosecutor basically prosecuting a highwayman, but it's a lone highwayman, like we were talking about. And in this speech, sort of like with what we have from another author about the Emperor Nero growing up, with this speech, we have even more specific detail. Oh, he grew up, he set fires, he broke into other people's houses, he committed violence against women, which is a euphemism for rape. The verb that's used in Greek is often used for rape. So he started out with smaller crimes. The story literally says, he progressed from smaller crimes to larger ones because he never paid the penalty for the smaller ones. So people didn't catch him, or they were like, well, slap on the wrist this time and please don't ever do it again. So the background of this particular person, again, sounds a lot like what you hear in terms of serial killers' early lives. So violence that progresses from being against objects and stealing things and abusing substances to attacking people. And then the story says, because he never paid the penalty, he progressed to the heinous crimes that he's committing now. He lurks outside the city limits. He watches from a hilltop to see who would make a good victim, and then he pounces, and then he tortures his victims by giving them hope that he might let them go, but then they're begging, like they're down on their knees begging him, and then he just kills them and chops them into pieces. And what's worse is he doesn't even leave the bodies whole in places where the families could find them and at least know that their loved one is completely deceased, or be able to bury the body properly, which was very important even back then. Again, there's very little said about the robbery aspect. The story focuses so much on the behavior and what we would call the psychological background of this highwayman, who sounds so much like so many modern serial killers in terms of his background and specific actions, like it's torture and mutilation, murder.
Yeah. And it would give, you know, potential prosecutors kind of a rubric in how to go after, you know, let's call it a lone wolf like that, right?
Yeah.
So staying with wolves and roads, and you talk about how people potentially came up with these ideas of, you know, bands of wolves attacking and leaving the mutilated corpses, and even supernaturally werewolves and vampires. Can you talk about that a little bit too? It's the right season.
Sure. I mean, this also relates to what we were talking about with the Theban Sphinx earlier, mm-hmm. that it's not like my own theory that some of these mythical monsters reflect serial killings. That theory has been tossed around for a while. And John Douglas, who was a serial killer profile for the FBI, at one point said in his book, Mindhunter, which they made it, that's actually another show that they had a couple of seasons of, but he said something to the effect that, you know, it's possible that tales of witches and vampires and werewolves, those kinds of creatures, it's possible that those stories that were being told and circulating around in early modern Europe were told because there were actually real people going around, you know, committing mutilation murders, but people just didn't want to believe that their fellow humans could be capable of that kind of incredibly horrific behavior, mutilation murders, and of children too. So John Douglas said, you know, maybe some of these stories were based on real life mutilation murders, and but it just was like only somebody who's only an animal could actually do that, or only a supernatural force could do that. And so there are other people who have looked at the Theban Sphinx as being a sort of a prototype of a serial killer. And there's a scholar who also looked at the monster Grendel from Beowulf as possibly being based on a serial killer as well. So again, it's not like I'm the only person who's like crazy enough to try to say, oh, the Theban Sphinx was a serial killer. The point isn't, again, it's not that the Sphinx was absolutely a serial killer. It's that there are elements of serial killing worked into a lot of these stories about mythological monsters, whether they're like these hybrid, you know, monsters of Greek myth or something a little more, I don't want to say pedestrian exactly, but you know, vampires or werewolves that are more widespread and generic in a certain sense. I mean, the Sphinx is a very specific monster. Werewolves and vampires are all over the place. And I mean, there are some famous ones, you know, like Bram Stoker's Dracula, but in general, there's a distinction between those and the specific monsters of Greek myth that were fought by heroes.
So when I was reading your book, you bring up Bram Stoker's Dracula, and it's been many years since I read that one, but everybody kind of knows if you brandish a cross towards a vampire, then he'll, he won't, or she, you know, will kind of shrink or it'll burn. But you also talk about how people would take trophies. The serial killers would take trophies even then. And we see that now as well, that's sort of part of the profile of serial killings. And it made me think of sort of, medieval Christianity and how they would have, you know, relics of saints. And it's almost like this perversion of an idea of, you know, religious idea, spirituality that is sort of, you know, inverted in the mind of these, you know, monsters that haunted society too.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a really neat way to put it, actually, because even in antiquity, in terms of the relic idea, you know, and trying to distinguish that from, well, what about the trophies of serial killers? How is this different or similar? That even in antiquity, there were relics of famous monsters kind of thing, or it'd be like, oh, look, this is the skeleton of a centaur, you know, and I mean, but they would, so they would look for these oddities and put them in museums, or rich people would want to acquire just this sort of thing, like this is the bone from the Sphinx, or maybe not specifically the bone of the Sphinx, but there absolutely were stories about that. Oh, they found a live centaur up in the mountains and they brought it down for the emperor, and now the skeleton is on display somewhere. So there were definitely relics in addition to trophies. And as far as saints' relics go, I mean, I don't know what sorts of distinctions we necessarily want to make, but in terms of how the saints died, I mean, because they were often executed, that's of course how they became saints in a lot of the cases. But it would be more of a formal state execution rather than, say, you know, a serial killing, in terms of the here's a bone that the serial killer is keeping versus here's the bone of the guy who was martyred. So there are certainly some similarities. But in antiquity, you've got stories of killers keeping the skulls of their victims and making shrines of them, for example. There are different motives, among the stories of keeping body parts, especially if that's one of the things that you're asking about, is especially like the keeping of body parts.
Right. I mean, I don't know. I just thought it was kind of fascinating how serial killers have been doing that, how, you know, and that was sort of something that was totally opposite from, you know, a religious rite that people would do when they would go and travel the roads to a shrine of something,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, you know, the Canterbury Tales is a great example of a bunch of people going out onto the roads in a group to stay safe and
yes.
Go see the shrine of Thomas a Becket, right? So, anyways, you don't talk about that in the book.
Well, no, but I mean, I've been to Canterbury Cathedral multiple times, and I always look at that spot where Thomas Becket was supposedly, was it beheaded or just attacked? I can't remember. But
I do think they took his head off, yeah.
You'd think if I had been there multiple times, I'd remember, but the last time was a while ago. But yeah, so going to these spots where, you know, that was, a sanctioned killing, or maybe not, like, I didn't really mean for you to go and kill him, right? Isn't that what Was it Henry? But just going to visit the spot where something like that happened, I mean, there is this weird fascination with killing and the circumstances of killing, and then what is represented by that spot or that person who was killed. And if it's an important person who's killed, there's something different there. Serial killers tend to not pick famous victims, for example. There'd be too much inquiry. Mm-hmm. So they will often pick people who this is why you hear about, say, prostitutes or homeless people being victims of serial killers so much more frequently, or Black children, for example. Oh, society doesn't care as much about them, so there are going to be fewer resources devoted to finding those killers. So it's a unfortunate and interesting difference.
Right. But I guess fascination with death, with crime is not new.
No, and we're all sort of fascinated by death because we're all going to have to go through it, and nobody really wants to think about it too much, depending on what your religious beliefs are, maybe. But it's like the manner of death has just been constantly a fascination. I don't understand the psychology necessarily enough to say why we are all, you know, why things like this tend to grab our attention. Hopefully it's partially because it's still relatively unusual. We pay less attention to deaths in war. I mean, there are thousands of people being killed in wars, you know, very often, but mm-hmm. those individual deaths somehow don't get as much attention as the, oh, you were a victim of a serial killer. There's more notoriety, it's more unusual, it's less sanctioned by society. I mean, not that we think wars are great, but people do make the decisions to go to war or to defend themselves or what have you, where serial killers are sort of a mentally different, they just think differently. And it's something people would like to understand also, like, is there a way to prevent this? And I'm thinking, I mean, you had mentioned this, the Dahmer series that's on, and I actually don't watch much of those reenactments, but I am watching The Patient. Have you seen that one? The one with Steve Carell as a therapist, and I think it's Domhnall Gleeson, who is playing a serial killer who wants to not be one anymore. And this is not a spoiler alert because it happens in the first episode. So the serial killer has kidnapped the therapist and brought the therapist back to his the serial killer's home so that he can have private sessions and try to get him not to kill anybody anymore. And that's sort of a new take. That's a really, you don't really hear about serial killers actually wanting to not kill anymore, because normally it's a compulsion or a drive that they're not even necessarily interested in addressing or curing, if such a thing is even possible. But yeah, no, the show is really interesting.
So it's very new. I haven't seen it. I have seen the preview, but a show that you do talk about is Dexter, where similarly he treats himself through this method of being within the crime investigation, and then he's able to inform how he murders. I don't know if we'll ever be lucky enough to find a source that shows us how fictionally people dealt with, through folklore tales or myth, that kind of complication. But certainly I think all of this, and your book included, says a lot about how, you know, we still have problematic relationships to death, to violence, and how it's really, serial killers may be a newer term, but the practice of serial killers is not new at all. So with that, I just want to remind everyone who's interested in this really wonderful union of ancient histories, myths, and true crime to pick up a copy of Monsters and Monarchs, Serial Killers and Classical Myth and History by Debbie Felton. Dare I say, it's cutting edge.
Oh, no.
Thank you, what, Debbie.
Oh, thank you for having me. I think what I could say is that it really is aimed towards a more general audience. I may be a scholar and a researcher, but what I try to do is public-facing scholarship, which is to make these old stories accessible to a broad audience.
It was great. I love it.
Those are some great questions. Thank you so much for having me and for asking all those great questions.
Of course. Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.